Welcome to That Makes Total Sense, a podcast dedicated to exploring God's generosity and justice. I'm Alexis Busetti, a Christian aiming to ask good questions and encouraging you to do the same. Every one of us is wired by God to live out generosity and justice, but the how sometimes eludes us. That Makes Total Sense is a way for us to get together, posture ourselves as learners, and challenge one another to practice generosity and justice in a tangible way every day. Hey, everybody. I am thrilled this morning, actually, to be sitting across from Shannon Polk, who, as of, I guess, close to the end of last year, has become the executive director of the Witness Foundation, which I'm hoping she's going to share about, because those of you who listen to the show know that I have spoken with Jamar Tisby a couple of times, who was the founder of The Witness. And so now they're kind of branching off and able to do some more things in ministry. And I'm so excited for Shannon to tell us more about that. She is an attorney. She is an ordained pastor with the Assemblies of God. So we kind of had a little connection there. That's where I met my husband, was at an Assemblies of God campus ministry. And Shannon is, I'm going to say you're an expert in this area of philanthropy. I think this is what we're going to talk about today, is philanthropy and generous giving. But I'm just so excited because we're going to take a little turn and look at this from a slightly different angle than maybe some of us are used to. So Shannon, fill in the blanks where I missed it, and correct me where I messed it up.
Well, I'm going to start off by saying thank you for that very generous introduction. I won't refer to myself as an expert. I'll just say that I have what I like to feel are informed opinions about how we can give better.
I like it.
And that I'm still a student and still learning all the time. But yes, I am the exec director of the Witness Foundation, and I'm from Michigan. That's my home. That's where I'm based. And
Flint, Michigan, right?
Mm-hmm. Yep, Flint, Michigan. You know, we had a little water situation.
Yeah,
we had a little water situation there. And so philanthropy is really big in my community, right? Mm-hmm. And so just understanding what philanthropy means in different contexts. I'm the president of the Junior League of Flint, right? So the way that different groups, cultural groups, look at giving, mm-hmm. and how they approach that, you know, so that's very different than the approach, say, of my local congregation or the congregations where I grew up. And just kind of understanding that framework of how people approach philanthropy, how do they approach giving and doing good? I think it's really important, especially as Christians, to really think about, why are we doing this? You know, interestingly enough, my devotional this morning was around the widow's mite, right? Mm-hmm. What does it mean to give? What does true giving really look like? And so I'm hoping that we'll have a chance to kind of talk about institutional giving versus individual giving, and how we correct some of the errors of institutional giving, because some of it's really good, but some of it not so much. And so hopefully we'll get into that too.
So when you say institutional giving and individual giving, define those two categories for us so we can kind of wrap our minds around what that looks like.
Right. So when I think of individual giving, I'm talking about, you know, the group of friends that get together because someone just had a baby, right? So we're going to give because maybe there's someone in our community that doesn't have enough. So we're going to do that baby shower for them, mm-hmm. or we're going to provide them some things because maybe their husband is ill, right? And so we're going to rally around them. That's that individual giving. You know, I care about foster kids. So I'm going to give to that, right? We know those. Institutional giving is, you know, what we often refer to in the sector as big P philanthropy, right? So those are those big foundations that are giving out millions of dollars. Sometimes it's a local community foundation, but it's organized, it's more formal. And, you know, they're giving out grants that people have applied for. They're giving out scholarships in someone's name who left a very large inheritance. And so that's what I think when I think of institutional giving. Now, what's important to understand about this, and this is part of the reason why the Witness Foundation was created, is that institutional giving is no different, is impacted by race, just like everything else in this country that's been racialized. It's really important to understand that the majority of those institutions are run by white people. Now, that in and of itself is not the negative. The issue becomes that there is a thing that I refer to and sociologists refer to as in-group preference, right? I like people who look like me, who listen to the music I listen to, who enjoy the same kind of activities. That's my social group. So what happens is that when I begin to look to make donations in my community, I'm going to reach out to people in the community that are already a part of my social group, already a part of my network. And for a lot of white people, the stats are that anywhere between 70 to 90% of your network is white, which means that when
it's shocking. Oh, what were you gonna say, Alexis? I mean, I was just going to say it was shocking to me the first time I heard that statistic. I feel like I'm going to ask you to repeat it because I think that white people need to understand what a huge deal even that is.
Right. So, you know, if I'm living in, I'll use the seminary where I graduated from. Springfield, Missouri is 90% white, which means, and there are lots of communities like that all across the US, right? They're 90% white. The interaction that people in those towns may have with someone who's diverse is extremely limited, which means their network is overwhelmingly white. So if they are in some type of Christian ministry and a position becomes open and someone says, hey, do you know someone I can recommend for that position? Look through your networks and see their network is overwhelmingly white and they're going to recommend somebody they know, that person is going to get the job. And then people look and go, how come we don't have any diversity within this institution? Well, it's where you're going to. If you're asking from within your network and your network is primarily white, then the results you're going to get are going to be primarily white.
But can we talk about two? I'm sorry. Oh, I'm like going to stop
the questions
you at some point. I say that. It's probably not true. But I'm thinking, because you mentioned Springfield, but I'm like, I live in Houston.
Mm-hmm.
And I will say, I don't have the stats on this, but I would bet mm-hmm. that, because Houston is not 90% white. Houston is an extraordinarily racially and culturally diverse city. But I would say maybe white in the white community in general, but in the Christian white community, I would still say those stats stand that 70 to 90% of their community is white, even in a community that is not that white. Like,
and 90% that's because
white.
Right. And that's because we live in segregated communities.
Right.
So like, for example, the school that my daughter attended last year had over 50 nationalities in it.
Wow.
The neighborhood I live in, there might be three families of color.
Right.
Why? Because we live in segregated communities. We worship in segregated communities. So we're only bumping up against each other at the grocery store, at the pharmacy. We are not having genuine interactions across cultural lines.
Yes.
So even though we choose to live in places like Houston, like Chicago, I mean, Chicago is known for their neighborhoods, right? I have an aunt, she lives in Bronzeville. Why is it Bronzeville? Because it's a predominantly Black area on the south side of Chicago. You're not seeing lots of other people from different ethnicities in those segregated enclaves. Now, I'm sure you've had this conversation before about redlining, and that's why we have such segregated neighborhoods. The issue is that that same kind of redlining happens in philanthropy, because if I'm running a foundation and I'm white and I'm looking to my networks when I get ready to hire, and those people are from my networks and the majority of them are white, and when we get ready to do a community scan of where we're going to put money, you know, we're looking to the community leaders that are recommended to us. Chances are those community leaders that are recommended to us to fund, they're going to be white. So unintentionally, you have a majority of those dollars going to white-led organizations.
That's huge.
So where do you begin to see Black leadership, leadership of color? Where do you begin to see those voices begin to raise up? You don't, because they don't have the same investment. Now, this is really important, because oftentimes you have white folks who are like, you know what, I have a vision, I have something I want to start. And so they start a nonprofit, and they're able to do this because maybe, you know, great Aunt Sally left you something in the inheritance, or maybe she really likes what you're doing, or Uncle Bob likes what you're doing. So he writes you a check because he wants to invest in this nonprofit that you're going to create. Well, that's fine, but that's because they have the disposable income to do that. When you look at the wealth gap between white families and communities of color, you know, oftentimes, you know, Shanae's grandparents can't give her that because they didn't have that to give, right? And so they're starting out at a disadvantage when it comes to wealth and being able to invest that money. And then that then goes into who's going to donate, right, to my cause. This is something I've seen in, I'm going to use the example of Young Life, right? Young Life requires all of their workers to raise their own funds. Well, I had a friend who was working for Young Life who told me, she said, when I look at my white counterparts in the suburbs, they can go, they can talk to their friends, their families talk to their friends. They have one dinner every year annually that raises all of the capital that they'll need to support their missionary journey for that year. She said, I could have 6 of those dinners in a year and still only get to 50%.
Right.
Because of the wealth disparity from my community as compared to theirs.
Right. And I will say, I just read something, I think it was in the Washington Post. But even with, I just kind of want to point it out because I think that sometimes people look at numbers or they look at situations like that, and there might be something there that says white people are, they just give more. They're more generous, possibly. I don't know if you've heard that, but I'm like, I'm looking at this and I'm like seeing some of these stats that are saying, yeah, but as a ratio to income and as a ratio to wealth, Black people give more of their money. Have you seen stats that are similar to that? Or
I have, and that does not surprise me because as we start off talking, it's like the widow's mite. You know, you have people that may be making $20,000 a year, but because they grew up in a Christian community that taught about tithing, they're giving that 10% directly to the church. And then they're giving above that because so-and-so graduated from college and they're going to need a little starting money. So-and-so just graduated from high school and we know they were raised by a single parent home. So we got to help them pay for books. So-and-so, their family got put out. So we're going to help them, you know, get back on their feet. So there is constant influx of giving by little granddads, little grandmoms and aunts and uncles, the community aunts and uncles that are like, hey, I've got a little extra. But then that puts a greater burden on those African-American families that do have a little bit of wealth because they may be some of the only ones that do.
Right, right. And they're wanting, they have a desire to give to all of the little things.
Exactly.
And all of the events, all of the people, because they can.
Right. And because it's not like there are 100 people in the community go to, there may only be 10.
Right.
That have enough wealth where it doesn't necessarily impact them in the same way that it does Grandma Jenny, who's giving out of her last, just like that widow. Like, you know what? Pastor said that we need to give to this charity. They're doing good work. They're helping kids learn how to read. You know what? Instead of paying for this thing I was going to buy over here, I'm going to give that. Most of the time in other communities, it's not the same sacrificial giving.
Right. Yeah. Yeah.
Because it is a sacrifice. And they're like, okay, instead of going out to eat, instead of doing this other thing, this is where I'm going to put my money towards this community investment because I know how important it is. And the other piece is because of that philanthropic redlining, I know no one else is going to give to it if I don't do it. Because it's not on anybody else's radar.
Talk about
that. Because they're not part of that community, right?
Talk about that a little more.
Yeah, so when you think about philanthropic redlining, it's just like the housing term of redlining. After the GIs came home and they were able to use their GI Bill from World War II, they thought they were gonna be able to go and buy these homes, right? They're so excited, you know, here they are, patriots, they've come back, they fought on behalf of their country. Only to be told, oh, I'm sorry, because there were three types of ways that they were excluded, right? They were either excluded because of redlining, meaning there had been a line drawn around communities saying, this is where the housing in this area, we are going to devalue that housing. We're not going to insure it at the same rates. And we're going to encourage certain groups of people to live there. And the reason why it was redlined was because they were high populations of communities of color, right? So because it was a Black area, we're going to redline that. The other thing was you couldn't move into other communities because of restrictive covenants, right? The covenants actually said, we cannot sell this land and we cannot sell this property to anyone who is not white, right? So you got that going on. So when you put those kinds of things together, what happens is that the house that, say, my grandfather would have purchased is now worth less than the house that my white friend's grandparents purchased. Why is that a problem? Because in America, one of the greatest ways to increase wealth is through inheritance. So someone's able to pay for college education by taking out a loan, an equity loan based upon the value of their property. Well, if your property is valued at 3 to 5 times, perhaps even 10 times the rate of what my property is valued, then you're going to have other educational opportunities, other investment opportunities that I, as an African-American living in this community that has been economically devalued by law, that limits the amount of capital and wealth that I'm going to be able to have. Now, you mentioned to me, you know, going to school in Oklahoma. One of the greatest examples of this is when you think about it is Black Wall Street in Tulsa.
Yes.
Right? Where you have a thriving Black community, but then through no fault of their own, it is burned down in the riots, right? That you had white people coming into that community and setting it on fire. So what happens to the churches? What happens to the business in that community? So then people have to move away, right? Start up again if they have capital to do that.
Right.
So what happens in a what happens to a group of people, right? When they have to start every generation rebuilding wealth from scratch.
Right. And I'm even going back, like my thought process went back a little bit further because my husband and I actually had the GI Bill conversation the other day. On, we have evening walks where we solve all of the world problems. You know, I don't know why we still have world problems because we solve them every night. But my grandfather was a recipient of the GI Bill when he came back from Korea, and I was just kind of in even in my own family comparing my white granddad who was a recipient of the GI Bill to my Mexican American granddad who had to drop out of elementary school when his mother died so that he could help the family economically. Right. And just these kinds of two things that even in my own family, you know, I could see, but one of the things I thought of was yes, inheritance, but I almost wanted to take it back a baby step in my mind to think that is if these GIs coming back of color could even purchase a home. Like, yes, if they purchased it, it would be worth less, but how many of them, and even now could not purchase a home, even in Oklahoma, like you mentioned, when I was doing my master's, my advisor was talking about the first African-American professor at the university where I went could not purchase a home close to the university.
Mm-mm.
Right. No. Because of the same things. And this was not like, oh, in the 1800s, right? Like we're talking about, you know,
1950.
Exactly. America, right? And it's like he's coming in as a professor. He legally cannot purchase a home near the university.
Right.
This is
and
crazy.
So, and this is all across the country. In my context of Michigan, I know the woman who was the first Black woman to buy a house near the university I graduated from.
Right.
In that area. She was the first. And oftentimes what they had to do is they had to go and have a white family purchase it for them.
Yes.
And then transfer it to them because they could not get approved to do that in their own name.
Right.
And so you bring up the other piece, which is, okay, so the only way I can purchase a home is if I get the job. Well, who's hiring, you know, Black GIs? Who's hiring Black female workers during that time? What industries are they relegated to or limited or have limited access to? Because all of that makes a difference
right. In
their earning potential. And so, for example, if you have an African-American man who says, look, I want to start this program for youth in my community, he is less likely to be funded than a white man who's also going to work with that same disadvantaged population of students. Why? Because that white man is connected to the networks of funding in a way that that Black man is not. And so when we think about that philanthropic redlining, so then what happens is that you have nonprofit organizations that have a wealth gap as well. So then the racial wealth gap is not just in individuals, now it's in institutions. which is why when that Boys and Girls Club was led by the African-American executive director, all of a sudden donations dropped off. Why? Because when it was a white executive director, people were like, oh, we're so excited about what so-and-so is doing. But I don't know about this other person's leadership. And a lot of this has to do with the fact that for most white Americans, they've never had to work under a leader of color. Whether that is having a pastor who was a leader of color, having a teacher of color, having a boss or a supervisor of color. So there becomes some real questions because of the fact that they've not had to address that framework, which brings up some latent issues for them around whose leadership they are willing to submit to and whose leadership are they willing to invest in. And that's part of the reason why it's so important. And so the work of the Witness Foundation is to say, look, we know that there are African-American Christians who are out there who have great ideas, who want to advance the kingdom, and we want to invest in them because we recognize that a lot of mainstream philanthropy doesn't get that far. Not because they're being intentionally exclusive, but just because when racism institutionalized, that system perpetuates itself without any other intervening actions. And so then as a result, no one has to come along and say, we're just not investing in African-American leadership. There are so many other things that led up to that system being created that it just perpetuates itself. And so we're saying we're going to be an intervening factor. We're going to identify those African-American leaders. We are going to train them so they have that support. And then we're going to invest financially in them because we know that they don't have access to the same capital as their white peers.
So talk about that. What's becoming more fascinating to me as I continue to listen to you is what you talked about at the beginning. You said, I hope we can talk about the institutional side of it, right? Because I had been thinking mostly about individuals giving to organizations, which is a legit thing, right? Like mm-hmm. that's a legit concern. And we've talked about that some. As I did a bit of reading, trying to prepare for our conversation, one of the things that struck me, and you're getting to it now, and I'm hoping you'll talk about it, especially in the Christian space, is these institutions that you're talking about, the ones who have the millions of dollars, right, to give grants and this, you know, this kind of stuff. And I was trying to find it just now, and I think I closed the tab. But there was an article I found, I don't even know, maybe from Nashville or something like that, about maybe there was one for a music program in Nashville and then one just talking about Black theater companies, right? Mm-hmm. And saying like, there was one stat that said something like, you know, of these white-led theater companies, their average annual budget, I don't know, $30 million, $50 million or something like that. But like the largest Black-led theater company, the annual budget was something like $3.5 million or something, right? Mm-hmm. Like a tenth of what right. these other companies, these other, you know, theater companies are going for. And it's like, because they're not getting the grants, this institutional side of it, right? So like, can you help me process that and talk through sure. that? And especially when it comes to the Christian spaces, what does that look like institutionally down?
So here's the thing, the U.S. has been racialized, right? As most Western European nations that have a history of colonization have, right? So we're a racialized nation. So race permeates almost every decision that's being made, whether openly or subconsciously, it's there. So I'm going to paint this picture for you. And so let's go from the individual to the institution, right? So we've talked about the person, I'll use myself as an example, right? My grandfather's grandmother was an enslaved woman in Mississippi. And so you can see generationally what the legacy and impact that slavery had economically within my family, right? So you have to deal with the Jim Crow laws, who's able to vote, who's able to buy property, who's able to live here, right? So you've got all of that. You've got the restrictive covenants that you had to deal with. So where do you get to live? So how much wealth then is able to pass from generation to generation? So there's a wealth gap between me and perhaps my white peer who was able to inherit wealth from their grandparents and their parents, and that made a decision on where they were able to go to school and what was affordable, where they had access to, right? Right. So now let's move from me as an individual to the institution, because the institution also suffered, because that institution had to buy property in an area, if they're going to be connected to community where the property is worth less, they're going to have access to a much smaller network where they may not have the same access to funds. Okay. So when you're comparing that neighborhood theater group that may be in an all-Black neighborhood as compared to the city symphony, right? That city's institution of fine arts, that city's institution of Institute of Music, they have access to $1 million funding because they are on the radar of those institutions that are giving millions of dollars because they're at the same dinner party. They're at the same fundraisers as well, where they're sponsoring a table and supporting this, and they're connected with the same Rotary groups and the same clubs. But that African-American nonprofit leader is not in those same networks. So they don't have the opportunity to sit across the table and say, so Joe, let me tell you about this new program we're getting ready to get started, right? Because those conversations happen over lunch. Those conversations happen at dinner parties. And what you have is you have an entire group of people that are not in the room where it happens, right? If we can quote Hamilton, right? They're yeah. not part of that conversation. They're not yeah. part of that network. So you have entire institutions that don't even, that aren't even aware because they don't have the grassroots connection to know who's effective in this community, who's doing this work. Now, this is really important because of the Christian model of missionary giving, right? And how we go into communities. Because that Christian model was, we're going in and we are going to civilize this group, right? We're going to bring the gospel and we're going to civilize them. If I can just be so transparent.
Do it. Yeah.
And so what happens is that that same approach is the approach that's taken in going into communities of color. We're coming in to help those little people over there that are so less fortunate that need us. It is not an asset-based philosophy. So we're already bringing in the institutional mindset of inferiority when working with communities. So you've got this power imbalance already, right? And so then as a result, how are you then going to look at that leadership? Are you looking at those leaders, indigenous leaders, as people that understand their community, have voice and should be trusted? Are you looking at them as, well, let's only give them a little bit of money. Let's give them a fraction of the money we would give to these other people because we're not sure if they have the competency to really manage this effectively. And so that's what happens in Christian institutions, because I heard a couple of different Christian nonprofit leaders talk about the fact that, you know, when they compare themselves to their white counterparts, whether it's something like, you know, teen ministries or even things like and this was one that's very close to my heart because I'm from Flint, right? I saw millions of dollars going overseas to build wells, and we could not get money in a low-income African-American community that was also suffering with dirty water.
Come
on. And yeah. could not get clean water.
Right.
Why was it so much easier to donate money to these other places? Because the leaders, I really do believe it's because those leaders look like the people that were making the investment. And so there was a sense of trust, that sense of in-group preference. I know you, you share my values, I can give to you. But these other people who are different from me, I don't know them as well. Can they really be trusted with that investment? And as Christians, we are supposed to see the imago Dei in all the people that God has created, right? I need to be able to look at you, even if you have a different skin color, and see that God made you, God gave you voice, God gave you presence. And if you're important to God, you need to be important to me. And so when I think about what white people can do to address this disparity, it's like, trust Black folks. Trust Black folks enough to make a financial investment. That's how you're demonstrating that with your dollars, that you're like, you know what? I trust that leader. Because that's what we do when we give to all the other major charities. We're saying we trust that leadership. Even sometimes when they are fledgling organizations. Because they all grew from somewhere. They all had to start somewhere. Are you willing to make that investment in that small nonprofit in your community that's doing good work, but doesn't necessarily have all the bells and whistles because no one's ever made that investment yet to give that to them, knowing that their community may not be able to support that because they're already working in a community that is economically disadvantaged.
And it's a cycle. It just perpetuates itself.
Mm-hmm.
So let's go back to the water for a sec, because I am wondering, and I feel like I've heard you allude to this in different conversations, but so the wells that are being dug overseas, many of them are being dug in Africa, right? And so you have Black people in need of water, clean water, on a different continent, albeit Black people in need of clean water, but white people are funneling the money to get the wells dug to get there. So white people kind of on this leadership level are providing the water for Black people who need it in Africa. And then you have your situation in Flint that you just talked about. I'm wondering, as you see organizations, and this is what I think you talked about with Tyler, organizations that the recipients or the people being ministered to, I guess, kind of for context or lack of a better kind of understanding of that, are maybe in a multicultural population or maybe mm-hmm. minority population, but the heads of this leadership. So let's pretend for a second, we have two mm-hmm. communities that the populations look very similar.
Right.
And one of the ministries has a leadership that is white. And one of these ministries has a leadership that is made up of minority people from minority groups. Does this exist? Do you see the difference because of the heads of these organizations, right?
Definitely.
That's kind of what I'm getting at. Can you mm-hmm. make sense of what I said and then tell?
Yeah.
So, I mean, talk through it in a way that makes sense.
Right. It's just like when you see this sometimes happen when there's a change of leadership in a church where the previous pastor was white and everyone's like, oh, this is great. We really enjoy that leadership. And then the church staff, for whatever reason, may say, you know what? We want to hire this Black person who's going to go in because we want a more diverse community. But then people begin to go, you know, and they begin to do some more serious questioning of that person's leadership ability, right? Like, well, you know, let me back up and say it this way. There's this concern that there is a higher level of questioning, that there's more reservations when you have a person of color in leadership, and they don't necessarily have as long of an opportunity to, as much of an opportunity and as long as a period of time to really win people over.
Because do you think that they, like leaders of color in those circumstances, don't get the benefit of the doubt?
Yes.
You know what I'm saying? So like, let's say you got a white pastor and you got a Black pastor and they're kind of in the situation that you're saying, and a month in, each of them makes a budget mistake, right? Mm-hmm. Like each of them makes a funding mistake or a budget mistake or something. I'm not talking about with people, right? I'm just saying like this, just, you know, the administrative level thing. And then somebody says, oh, gee whiz, he's new. You know, why don't you give him the benefit? Let's just keep going. And then all of a sudden on this side, maybe they say, ooh, yeah, I guess he really couldn't handle what we thought he could. Or, you know, he doesn't have a finance degree, maybe, or a business degree. Maybe that's the problem here. Maybe we should readjust what we're doing. Do you see?
And so Alexis, think about it this way. It's just like when all the studies have been done that shows that when a person has a more African American sounding African-American sounding name or something that identifies as African-American on a resume, they are less likely to get called in for an interview.
Right.
Even when they have the same credentials as the person with a name that sounds more white, right? So if your name is, you know, Trayvon, you are less likely to get called for an interview than if your name is William.
Right.
Even if you both have Ivy League degrees, even if you both have the same internships, because we live in a racialized society.
Right.
So there's this bias that the closer to whiteness you get, the better it is. And the further from whiteness you go, the less competent it is, the less safe it is, the less that we embrace it. And that is problematic. And so when you see that then hitting the institutions of the church, right? When you see that happening, that's when you get into the fact that you have organizations that are not being funded at the same rate and the same pace, even though they're doing the same work, simply because the leader of that organization is not white. Now, are there some exceptions to the rule? Sure, there are some exceptions to the rule, but they are very limited. And when we think about the fact that you've got communities of color in particularly African-American communities where you're not developing indigenous leaders and you're not making that investment in the church, I think the church is missing an opportunity.
Yes.
And when we think about, okay, equity in our giving, what does that look like? You know, to me, that's just saying that, you know, we want to make sure that as we're giving, that we're giving to those that are in need. And if we know that we have communities that are in need, then why wouldn't we give to those leaders? Why are we reserving and saying, well, I don't know them as well, I don't understand? You wouldn't necessarily have those same reservations if the leader was white. So why are you having those reservations? Because the leader is not white. Make the investment. See this person. And part of it is, if you don't see the person as a peer, then it's gonna be very difficult for you to see them as a leader. And that goes into what I mentioned earlier about, you know, going into the community with a missionary mentality, inferior, superior, right? That's one of the reasons why I think it's really important that the white evangelical church really begins to listen to communities of color and to Christians of color, because we have a lot to say that is really helpful to the church writ large. But if you've only seen us as communities that are in need and you're operating from the noblesse oblige principle of, because I have been given all these things, I must give to these poor little people down here, it's going to be hard for you to receive our wisdom. And it's going to be difficult for you to receive our leadership.
Right. It's.
And you're only going to invest with strings.
Because you're right. It's that peer relationship hasn't existed. It's the kind of the language of, it's my job to minister to this community and mm-hmm. not it's my job to minister with this community, right? Like we're not partners in this necessarily, right?
It's
exactly as you say, it's this hierarchical, not a peer-based relationship. But I just keep thinking about how the cycle, this like racialized cycle just keeps continuing, because it's like, well, it's this way in part, as you mentioned, because I've never had a leader who looks like this leader? Well, then you're not have confidence in that leader. So you're not going to support that leader. So then you never will, you right? never will have a leader who looks like that leader, right? You never will have a boss who looks like that boss, because you're not willing to, you know, no one's willing to do that. And then it just keeps perpetuating.
And I think one of the other pieces of that too, it's, you know, is being able to deal with the discomfort and the cognitive dissonance that people have in seeing leaders of color in positions they did not expect them to be, right? Because you see the same cognitive dissonance when people see women in positions of leadership that they did not expect them to see, right?
I've been thinking
They're going into the room. They're like, wait, so you're the CEO? Yes, I'm the CEO. Oh, I was expecting a guy. That's all, you know, I'm totally comfortable with your leadership. Really what's happening is there's a discomfort in them because they just made an assumption that the CEO of that company would be a man. Oh, the same thing happens. It's that same cognitive dissonance when they're like, oh, wait, so this is being led by a person of color. I mean, that's good, but I just didn't expect it. And sometimes it can take some time to deal with that cognitive dissonance and get comfortable with the fact that, you know what, that's unusual to you. So now you've got to get used to a new norm.
Well, and I think too, it is going to be reliant upon people inside the majority community to A, recognize that that's what they're feeling, right? Recognize that this is a cognitive dissonance and asking why. Why does this exist? Why was I expecting a white man to walk in when a Black woman walked in, you know, and being willing to do the work internally of dealing with that cognitive dissonance. And I'm not saying that it's only on an individual level, but it is also on an individual level, I think, where that needs to happen, because I think the person needs to be able to ask him or herself, what is that I'm feeling? If it's discomfort, I can name that. why am I feeling uncomfortable? Oh, because I expected, you know, I liked Austin Channing Brown's book, right? Because she talks about this a lot because of her name, right? She's like, I even sent you a picture and you still expected a white man, right?
Oh, I love that about her. I love that about her book because that had been my experience so often where I would go into a situation where like, okay, we're waiting for the person from the foundation. I'm like, I am the person. Well, is someone else coming with you? No. Well, who makes the decision about this grant? Actually, I do.
Right.
And we're off to a really rocky start now.
Right. Right. Yeah. Yeah.
Because they just didn't expect someone who looked like me to come in. You know, my name is Shannon. So they were, you know, I assuming they were expecting some redheaded Irish woman. I don't know. That's not who I am. And so they were experiencing that same cognitive dissonance around like, oh my gosh, well, what do I do now?
Right.
Because I may need to adjust the conversation. And there's nothing wrong with recognizing you need to adjust your expectations. I just need you to do it.
Right.
Right. And that nonprofit leader in your community needs you to make that adjustment. They need you to do that. I think what's really critical is that also people begin to take a look at their networks, take a look at where you're giving, and then begin to diversify that. The same way we've encouraged people, diversify your bookshelf. Mm-hmm. Diversify Amen. Who you're listening to, right?
Right.
Diversify who you're learning from. You need to diversify your giving. Take a look at where you're giving, where your dollars are going, and are they all going only to white-led organizations?
Right.
Then you need to examine that because why is that the case?
Right. I mean, I'm going to say my husband and I did that. We did that at the beginning of the year. We were kind of resetting some budget things. And I had read Jamar's newest book. And and so I got to have a little peek of that before it was released. So it was the time frame is what I'm saying, like the time frame of that. And so and we went through and we looked and we were like, dang it. You know, like we did have some diversity in there. I'm not gonna say we didn't have any. We for sure did. But when I would say what it was for us, and I'm just going to throw it out there because I want to be, you know, semi-vulnerable in this space. What I would say is what we noticed about ours was that our international giving was diverse, but typically our domestic giving wasn't.
Now I have some thoughts about that. Not you personally, but just, right. So I was having a conversation one day with a woman who was braiding my hair. She was from Cameroon and she was bemoaning the fact that she felt that African-Americans in this country weren't really taking advantage of all that it was there to be American and that sort of thing. And I stopped her in the middle of the conversation. I said, so can you tell me why you came to the United States as opposed to going to France when you decided to leave Cameroon? Because that is the country that colonized you. You already speak French. Why wouldn't you go to France? And she had this look on her face. I said, the same reason why African-Americans have such a hard time in the U.S. because this is the country that colonized us. I said, there is this issue and there is this tension, right? That happens. And so as a result, people are much more willing to give in diverse ways internationally than they are domestically.
Wow.
And so we have to begin to understand how we view the folks that are from this soil.
Right.
And how do we do that in a way? And historically, we have to understand that that's something that started in the founding of the country. I mean, Native Americans were not identified in our Constitution. Black folks were identified as 3/5 of a person. You know, at the same time, if you go a little bit further, same time you had Jim Crow laws, you had Juan Crow laws in Texas. I mean, historically, we as the United States just have a real hard time dealing with race and dealing with people that are non-white. Legally, right? Institutionally, that has been the case. Whether you're talking about the Chinese Exclusion Act, I mean, these are things that have created a bias in the minds of Americans that says, boy, if I'm getting this, the closer the proximity to whiteness, the better that this item is, this person is, this institution is, right? That's when you talk to people about, hey, what about moving into this neighborhood and sending your kids to the school? They're like, oh no, I would never send my kid to a school that was predominantly non-white. I'm not going to go to a church that's predominantly non-white. I'd feel too uncomfortable. Well, why would you feel so uncomfortable? Why is that so difficult? What is that stirring up in you that makes you feel like that's not going to be good? that the quality is going to be less.
Right. Right.
You know, that's that whole white flight. Oh, we got to leave. Why? Because the neighborhood is getting darker. Because inherently in the mind of those individuals, they're like, our property values are going to go down. That's the institutionalized part. That's the part that people are buying into subconsciously and they're not even aware of it.
Right. No, you're right. You're right. And, and I think that that's, we have to take these steps every, whenever we recognize it, we have to take the step. Or if we, even if it's not a feeling of discomfort, when we were just looking at the budget, it was like, what is it about that? Right. It wasn't that my husband and I intentionally sought out major organizations that were led by white people. It was exactly how you kind of referred to, but it was kind of, oh, well, this is what comes on the radio, or this is what's here, or this is, it's just what is. And because of the system that you have described, it is more difficult. We have to be intentional about seeking out organizations that don't necessarily fit that profile. And so, you know, I'm just going to be honest about, you know, some of the stuff that we did inside of our budget was we were not necessarily looking to take anyone off the list, but we did. We ended up doing it because honestly, in 2020, we saw some organizations that happened to be Christian and white run show some of their true colors when it came to what we experienced in 2020 with the racial reckoning in America and in the church. And I'm just going to say it. And so, you know, there was one organization that we had been giving to monthly. I don't even know how long it was. And it, I wrote an email and it broke my heart, you know, to kind of, you know, our monthly contribution is going to have no impact on their budget. Okay.
Gotcha.
They're not crying a river. They didn't come and say, you know, beg us to come back or anything like that. But for us, it was this moment of putting our money where our mouth is, right? We putting, you know, putting our treasure where our heart is, lining that up. For us, it was a reckoning. We had to realize what is it about this now? You know, we need to make some adjustments. We have to ask ourselves those hard questions. And so we weren't necessarily looking to take anybody off the list, but we did take some off. And we intentionally, we had been listening to voices in this space. Specifically, we've been listening to Black voices in this space. We've been listening to these multicultural voices in some of these spaces with these organizations. And it was like, okay, again, now it's time to put our money where our mouth is. We have been benefiting from the education that these organizations, these individuals have been providing for us. Now we need to contribute to what they're doing so they can further what they're doing. But these are places that you wouldn't necessarily just hear on Christian radio or when you open up a magazine or whatever it is. You know, these aren't the people who are sending out flyers every holiday or something like that, right? So we have to intentionally look for those spaces to invest in. And that is something that we wanted to do. And so we started doing, but it really has not just in that those little budget lines, but it is really shaping how we look at our giving. It's shaping how we look at our investment when it comes to ministry. And so I'm really thankful for that part. Honestly, a lot of that came from Jamar's book. He talks a lot about that and how to fight racism. Mm-hmm. You know, what you can do with your money.
Right. When it comes and it's so, it requires intentionality, right? When I was a child, my father took me every Saturday to a Spanish language school that was in our town so that I could hear all of the, it was a storybook time and every story was read in Spanish, right? There's an intentionality that has to be done if you're going to be inclusive, if you're going to be justice minded, if that's a value, it doesn't just happen by chance, right? So it's the deliberate evaluation of your budget, you and your husband sitting down and going, okay, let's take a critical look at this, right? That to me is part of, you know, Jamar talked about in the first book, Color Compromise, this idea of the arc, and then goes into a deeper dive in how to fight racism. But, you know, okay, so you're aware, right? You're aware that there's this philanthropic redlining. You're one of those people's like, look, I just don't want to do, I don't want to just look good. I want to do good. I don't want to just be seen posing with a donation, and I don't just want the little sticker on my fridge of that, oh, I gave to this, you know, poor child in a different country. I want to actually make sure I'm doing good, not just internationally, but also domestically, around the corner, perhaps from where I live,
yes,
and where I work and where I worship. Okay, great. So now you're building some relationships, you're learning, you've got that, but now it's time for a commitment, right? It's where do you begin to really decide, okay, this is where the rubber meets the road. This is how I can actually apply what I've learned, and either through the books or through listening to the lived experience of other people who are sharing with me, this is my truth. And so then this requires you then to begin to be like the Good Samaritan, right? I preached on this a couple of Sundays ago, right? This idea of your time, your talent, and your treasure. What are you doing with that? You know, because to see somebody hurting, that requires your time. If you're going to change how you're doing your philanthropic giving, it's going to take some time for you to then look and say, okay, so where do I give? It's going to take some time for you to investigate who are the organizations that are representing communities of color that share my Christian values that I can make that investment in. And then, you know, it's your talent. You know, one of the things, when you look at that parable of the Good Samaritan, it wasn't just that he stopped, but obviously this person had some kind of medical training, because then he began to apply ointment, he anointed, and he applied bandages, right? So what is it that your talent, because in addition to giving the money, maybe you have a skill set to then donate that you can support these organizations. Maybe you're an accountant. Maybe you're a professional fundraiser. Maybe you are in marketing. Can you give some of your talent to that organization as well? Are there some ways that you can be supportive that way? And then finally, yes, with your treasure, because money answers all things. So, you know, at one point, are you willing to say, you know what, I'm willing to make that monthly commitment the same way I have to every other Christian organization? I'm willing to be that monthly supporter, or I'm willing to make that major investment that I know that this organization needs.
Yeah.
It's, to me, it's basic Bible.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's basic Bible. We know in scripture that God is no respecter of persons. We know that it, according to scripture, when we look in Acts and we look at the dream that Peter had, you know, this idea of like, look, I don't want to see any more division in my church along ethnic and racial lines. I'm telling you, these people are clean. They are holy because I've made them holy. We look at the Revelations church, right? We look at Revelation 7 and we see that church of all nations, all tribes, all times, right? We know this is God's heart. So when we do, we change our giving focus and we make sure that we're including organizations that are led by people of color, what we're really doing is aligning our heart with God's heart.
Yes.
And I always tell people when I'm talking about this, I'm like, we're not doing this because it's trendy. We're doing this because God cares.
Yes.
And I want to care about the things that God cares about. And, you know, we're supposed to give honor to those parts that have not received honor in the body. And we think about communities of color, when we think about leaders, I mean, when you think about your leadership library, most of those voices in the Christian space are white men. Mm-hmm. You barely see women at all, let alone men of color and people of color. And so just like our reading libraries are not diverse, the way the leadership across the board is not diverse. So how do we begin to raise those leaders up? How do we begin to make those investments? Because we've always believed in indigenous leadership and supported that. We know that if you're from that community, you know that community. You're invested in that community. So why would we invest in Christian leaders that are indigenous leaders to those populations? That's just logical.
Yeah. In the time that we have left, can you talk to us about the witness and tell us what you guys are doing with the foundation? And sure. How are you putting these things that we've talked about in this conversation? You know, how are you guys addressing that at The Witness?
Yeah. So what we're doing is we just started evaluating and interviewing folks who are part of who have applied to be part of our first cohort of fellows. When we looked at the issue and we said, okay, so what is it that we can do? We know we want to identify leaders. We want to train them. We want to fund them. But what does that look like practically? We designed a program. It's the Witness Fellowship Program. And what we are doing is for our first cohort is we're identifying 5 African-American Christian leaders that we're going to make an investment in over the course of 2 years. And we are going to support them, number one, with funding. We're going to give them, each of these leaders is going to receive $50,000 each year for that 2-year period. So over the course of that time, they'll get $100,000. in unrestricted capital, because we don't want to hamstring them. We are saying to them, we know that you know best how to use those dollars. So we're going to make that investment in you. We trust you. We see God in you, and we're not going to restrict you in that way. Secondly, we're going to provide training, very intense leadership training around things like spiritual formation, which we know is so critical in leadership, around management, organizational management, and organizational development that we know is critical to make sure they receive the support that they need as they are growing and developing as leaders in that space. They are also going to receive executive coaching sessions, as well as a mentor, help walk them through this process. And all of their work will culminate with a capstone project that they will design and then present, because we want them to be able to contribute back to the sector in multiple ways. So that's one of the things we're doing. One of the other things that we're doing is we are providing training and support for people that are donating to us, because we understand and we want to build relationships with individuals. We don't want, although we appreciate the giving, we don't want to just be transactional. We want it to be based in relationship. One of the other things that we've done is we are looking at folks that want to create regional fellowships, because they're like, look, we're from this community. We know we have an African-American population that needs our support. And so we want to invest in a leader. So we have communities that have decided we want to raise and develop the money for to have a fellow from our area. And so we see some of that happening as well. And so we're supporting them. But in addition to doing that, we're partnering with those groups on the ground saying, okay, so how do we support you as you're doing this justice work? What are other ways that we can come alongside of you and help your local community as you begin to think about what are the best ways that we can begin to repair, right? And have true godly reconciliation in our local community. So those are just a couple of things that we're doing at the foundation to really support this work. We look at the work that the Witness of Black Christian Collective is doing as they are providing that education. So they are the words. And then we look at ourselves on the foundation side as the deeds.
Oh, that's good. That's really good. And so if I'm going to put links to these, to the foundation and to the BCC in the notes for this, but, can you talk a little, just like, because it used to be just the Witness BCC and now the foundation has been added. So can you talk maybe just like a little bit about that transition and kind of what, what prompted that?
Oh yeah. So the origin story, you know, I'm a Marvel superhero fan. So I love a good origin story.
That's
so
awesome. My husband just started WandaVision while I was at class the other night. And he was like, yeah, you wouldn't like it. It's Marvel. It's whatever he, but he said, you would love the story is what he said. You would love the story, but I don't know about the Marvel part, but
the story is amazing. I finished it. And I loved it.
Good. I'll tell him.
But what I will say is, so for our origin story, you know, you had Jamar and Tyler, they were working initially with the Reformed African American Network, and then realizing that they wanted to build a wider tent, and then making then the Witness a Black Christian Collective, a place to, you know, for Black folks that were coming out of predominantly white spaces, a place to kind of sit with some of the tension of what does it mean to be a Black Christian in America? What does it mean to be a Black Christian that's in white evangelical spaces? What does it mean to be a Black Christian who is trying to navigate the truth of the gospel, but understanding that you're understanding the role that your culture plays when you approach the text, right? And so out of the Witness BCC came this amazing platform where there were articles being written on issues that were very critical to Black Christian development and Black Christian thought, as well as a series of podcasts that were there to kind of, you know, for folks all across the US to be able to say, oh my goodness, somebody gets that. They get this thing I'm feeling of being a Black Christian in predominantly white spaces. And so out of that, there became the Joy and Justice Conference. And they said, hey, how can we gather folks together? We want to honor 400 years since the Reformation, but we also want to honor the 400 years since slavery came to these shores, and do that by, you know, lifting up some really amazing voices who can speak to the Black Christian experience in the US context. And so in part of in doing that, what they came to understand was just the difficulty in fundraising. So here they are with national platforms, books that have already been published, people that have called upon them and said, hey, can you come and speak to us? Can you come and educate us? We want to glean from you. We want to learn from you. Only then to find out that the same doors weren't necessarily open when it came to funding, when it came to investing in the conference. And so it was at that point that, you know, through some conversations, Jamar said, we need funding.
Yeah.
We need to create a space where Black Christians can get funded without this sense of dread of, oh my goodness, we have work we want to do, but are we ever going to get the funding to do this? There are things that we can make happen, but even if you have a large enough profile, are people still going to be willing to give because they aren't used to giving to Black-led nonprofit Christian organizations? And so it was out of the frustration and what they experienced in developing the Joy and Justice Conference, they said, you know, we need to do this. And so after a series of conversations, I was brought on board, and that's where we are with the Witness Foundation today.
Oh, thank you for sharing that. That just like, it just sheds so much more light and kind of puts a real tangible lens on just the very things that that we've been talking about. So I appreciate you. I appreciate you doing that. And I'll put the link to how people can fund the foundation. And so just to throw it out there, I mean, I don't normally share all my, you know, budget, everything with everybody, but I mean, my husband and I do give monthly to the Witness Foundation. This is a place where we feel like, yes, we are learning. We are benefiting from the work that you guys are doing. And, you know, understanding that we want to, I said this, I had a conversation with A.D. Thomason. He wrote a book called Permission to Be Black. And it was, and what I said to him, I think kind of applies here as well, but recognizing that we want for that space to be held, that Black Christian collective, we want that space to be held, but also recognizing at the same time that we are gleaning from what you guys are producing. And so we want to say, thank you. Thank you for letting us come around the edges, right? Thank you for leaving some for us, because even though we definitely want to affirm the space that you're creating, I can't let it slip by and say that it's only a space that's benefiting the Black Christian collective. This is benefiting the kingdom at large. This is benefiting the church at large. This is benefiting the white American Christian, you know, community. And we want to, you know, in a small way that we can invest in that work so that you guys can keep planting and keep harvesting, because it's beneficial for the kingdom. So anyway, this is a place, if you've heard this and you think, I want to be intentional, I want to find a place that I can give that's not currently on my list. I mean, I'm just going to personally put that link out there and personally recommend that you take a look at the Witness Foundation, because you guys are doing good work, Shannon. I appreciate it.
Thank you. We're currently in the middle of a peer-to-peer campaign. So please include some of your friends and family. You can go to our page on GiveButter as well to learn more about that. Find out about that on our Instagram page and our awesome. Facebook page.
Awesome. Yes, we'll put all of
this. But thank you, Alexis, for allowing me to have this conversation. This isn't something that's talked about widely in the church about how we diversify our giving to make it inclusive of the entire body of Christ.
Yeah.
And I think it's really important.
It is a super important conversation. Yeah. I mean, I'm really thankful to be able to even just have my eyes opened to what's happening. So anyway, I appreciate it, Shannon. I'm just so incredibly thankful.
Thank you again.
The links for all the resources mentioned in today's episode can be found in the show notes. Music and podcast production by Seth Busetti. Be sure to give us a review on iTunes and subscribe at your favorite podcast listening app. You can also visit us at thatmakestotalsense.com.